I should first make an amendment to the abstract book. Namely, this is a joint work with Robert McCann. I didn't write it in the abstract, but now I say it. There is another amendment to the abstract book. There will be little pieces of the talk which are actually intended as an introductory lecture to certain tools. For the younger people who may know a lot about transport, maybe more than I do, but may not know everything about hypergeometric functions or whatever. And so in those cases, I have a little cross or dagger symbol available here, but that will come up later. So in any case, you have already seen the introduction or a introduction to this talk, namely Robert's lecture. So I can be a bit brief here. So I'm going to discuss the fast diffusion equation, and I have some exotic notations here because I'm going to recycle the U and the T later for most of the time of the talk. So Y and tau. So this is the fast diffusion equation. Let me just recall briefly the basic or some basic facts about the dynamics. So for m larger than zero, so here I wanted m less than one, then it's the fast diffusion equation. There exists a unique solution for non-negative L1 data. Actually, L1 log is sufficient. So you don't need any growth estimate at infinity for m less than 1, which is due to the fact that you have such a fast diffusion. Such a fast diffusion for small V, but such a slow diffusion for large V, because M is less than 1, so that this prevents growth at infinity gathering or running too quickly into zero and blowing up. So growth at infinity does no harm. This has been done by Herrero and Pierre in... I wrote down when it was. No, I didn't. Sorry. Something in the 80s. 86, thank you. And for m larger or equal 1 minus 2 over the dimension, the solution is mass-preserving. For m less than 1 minus 2 over n, you have such a fast diffusion that you get a flux at infinity, and so you have actually finite extinction. And so let me just sketch the whole picture a little bit. So here you have the m-axis. To the left of zero, for negative m, you have no solutions. So here is m equals 1. Here is, let's say, 1 minus 2 over n. So leaving this out, here you have existence and uniqueness for L1 log data. I always assume that the data are non-negative. Otherwise, some results may change a little bit, and I don't really care. And here you still have existence and uniqueness for... that goes up to 1. And beyond, you still have existence and uniqueness for L1 data. There is a famous example by Witter that even for the m equals 1, for the heat equation, you get non-uniqueness if you don't assume any bounds, and not only on the data, but also on the space for solutions. But I'm concerned with m less than 1 in any case here. So here we have finite extinction. And here we have mass preservation. Even beyond. So here, this is of course the porous medium equation. Here you have the heat equation, and here you have the fast diffusion equation. Another thing is, there is a special solution in the calculus 1-3 sense. You just plug it in and check it. This is the Barenblatt solution. And it is a scaling solution. So I leave the scaling out and just give you the profile. So here you have R square plus some constant. Well, you may have another constant here, never mind, to the negative 1 over 1 minus m. And you see, if m goes to 1, you have a problem here. Of course, then here you get the heat kernel. Again, I forget about the constant. Well, let's make it 2 or 4, whatever you like. And here you have constant minus r squared to the 1 over m minus 1, also maybe another constant. And so this is the shape, or these are the shapes which you have seen in the previous talk. Now, within this range, the Barenblatt solution is actually in L1. Here, it's no longer in L1, so including this critical exponent. So it's not in L1, and therefore you might say it's irrelevant. Well, what's relevant and what's irrelevant is always up for discussion. And we are going to discuss convergence of solution to this shape, and it has been shown by Friedman and Kamin that it always converges to this shape in the range above 1 minus 2 over n. Well, actually, they worked it out above 1 and noticed or claimed that it can be done in this regime as well. So to capture this convergence, we need to rescale the space in a time-dependent way, such as to fix such as to make these scaling solutions actually stationary solutions of the evolution. So I'm not only fixing the variance by just saying let's rescale everything to the variance, but I want to have a dynamic for the rescaled solution. And here is the transformation. So you have y equals e to the t times x. Tau is e to the alpha t minus 1 over alpha. Well, maybe I should write alpha tau plus 1. It was called alpha t plus 1 in the previous lecture. Equals e to the alpha t. And so if you remember that we had power laws of convergence in the last lecture, that of course referred to this variable, and now in this variable that will show up as an exponential convergence, and this exponential convergence will be determined by an eigenvalue problem. Let me finish this. So you have u of t comma x equals e to the n t times v of tau y, and now you do the transformation and you find the following equation: ut equals Laplace of u to the m plus the divergence of x times u. And I call this the confined fast diffusion equation. Well, fast, of course, only if m is less than 1, and this is what I'm concerned about here. Now, this scaling has a side effect, namely it destroys the... I have seen a pointer. Okay. It's too short, huh? Good enough. It destroys the translation invariance of the equation up here. And we will have to discuss this later. Now, from an infinite dimensional dynamical systems point of view, the convergence towards equilibrium, the speed of convergence, is just determined by linearizing the evolution operator about the equilibrium solution and looking at the spectrum. And so there are two ways of linearizing things. Depending on the linear structure. And I'm going to write down both, but I will work exclusively with one of them, namely the one which uses the formalism of Felix Otto. So one is, of course, you could say U is in L1, and you have a Banach space structure, and then you say U equals the Baron-Platt solution plus epsilon times phi, and you get an equation. Where is my equation? So, well, you get an operator Laplace rho to the m minus 1, I guess, times Laplace phi plus, let me just have a look, divergence of x phi. Well, no big surprise. It actually looks quite similar to what we are going to get in the in Felix Otto's approach, and so this goes via a formal Riemannian manifold. And so let me just recollect the data which we get here. I guess I can take this away for a moment. Oh no, that fits just in here. So we have, oh, let me adapt the notation, that was called P2 of Rn. So these are just the probability densities with second moments. And so this is considered like a Riemannian manifold. And so the tangent vectors psi are vector fields on Rn. And so you need a norm for the Riemannian metric. And this is integral gradient psi squared u. And so exponential at u as psi. So that means you start on the manifold at u, go in direction of the vector psi as straight as you can, and with the length s times the length of psi, and this is just the identity matrix plus s times gradient of psi, push forward u. And so the geodesics just interpolate between measures by means of the Brenier map. And the global metric is the Wasserstein distance. So this is a very pretty picture, and actually it's so pretty that it has a sedating effect. And in order to counter this sedating effect and to issue some warnings, I want to stress why this is only a formal Riemannian manifold. This technical issue will not play a role for anything I'm going to do, but I think one should be aware of these problems, because otherwise one may draw too quick conclusions, and so this is a little bit on infinite dimensional Riemannian manifolds. So if you have never learned about infinite dimensional Riemannian manifolds, well, for most practical purposes, it's easy to learn they don't exist. Well, of course, you can make definitions, but these typical applications don't fit the definitions. So you don't take from your shelf or from the library shelf the book on these manifolds with all the definitions, and you don't quote any theorems. Unlike classical finite dimensional Riemannian manifold. So what is simply happening is whenever you try to do infinite dimensional Riemannian manifolds in a practical setting, it's always functional analysis that spits in the face of differential geometry. And this is nothing to be worried about. This root behavior is just common practice in infinite dimensions. So you should just know it, so that you aren't caught off guard.
The first three conferences, it is very supportive point of view.
Pardon?
The first three conferences of this workshop, it is very much supportive point of view.
What I'm claiming here?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
In all books, I would not bring this
inside.
In all books, I would not bring this inside.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying this to put these things down. Actually, I think this analysis is very pretty. Only because it's so pretty, that's why I said it has a sedating effect. So let me just point out a few of the technicalities which you need to be aware of. You might wonder, why do we want to have second moments? There is nothing visible like a second moment here in this Riemannian metric. Well, but it's in the global for the Wasserstein distance. Now, that's one of the funny things. Another, so here you have a Hilbert space. Well, of course, with the Riemannian manifold, you want a scalar product in the tangent space, so you better do have a Hilbert space. However, the manifold itself, well, these are probability density, so it's something like L1. Even if you add a weight, it still doesn't make it Hilbert. And the local geometry in infinite dimensions feels this. So the local geometry knows whether the topology comes from a Hilbert space structure or not. So that means a neighborhood in the tangent space will not be homeomorphic, let alone diffeomorphic, to a neighborhood on the manifold at that very point where the tangent space is intended to be tangential. So this exponential map cannot be expected to be surjective, which is, from the point of view of finite dimensional Riemannian geometry, of course, an outrage. So we might ask whether this manifold is complete. What is a complete manifold? Well, let me tell you what is a non-complete manifold in two dimensions. For instance, the plane with a hole punched out. You can see it in two ways, and in finite dimensional Riemannian geometry, they are equivalent. If you start at a point and go straight ahead along the geodesic, you might suddenly run into the hole, and this geodesic cannot be continued. The other thing is you may have two points where there is no geodesic, namely if they are just the punched out hole. So the equivalent is called the Hopfrenov theorem. Well, we don't have even this basic theorem here, because if you have two probability densities with second moments, well, you can take the Brownian map, so you have a connecting geodesic. However, if you want to continue this, well, this may cease to be bijective, and so it may cluster mass on a set of smaller dimensions, so you don't have anything absolutely continuous anymore. So even this equivalence breaks down. Now that's the bad news, but nevertheless, this whole picture is very strong for giving insight and to intuition. The only thing is you need to domesticate functional analysis, and so you don't use soft theorems by referring to anything, but you claim what it seems to suggest, and then you prove it without the book on infinite dimensional Riemannian geometry. You just do it by hand. So this is why it's still very, very helpful and can be done in... So whatever needs to be done can often be done with this type of formalism. Okay, so that ends that stuff on Riemannian geometry. Now... That was too quick. Now let's see. The confined fast diffusion equation is the gradient flow. Of course, this is also formal then. And you know the caveats now. Negative 1 over 1 minus m integral u to the m dx. Well, there is a little change. Because now I'm discussing the confined flow x square u. Well, always dx over Rn, of course. And so you can formally write this as ut equals the gradient, negative gradient of E of u, and the gradient is, of course, determined by this Riemannian structure in a way as has been specified in the previous talk. Now, you would want to do a linearization about rho. Rho is the Barenblatt profile. So the derivative of a gradient is, of course, the Hessian. And I should say about the Barenblatt profile, now, of course, this formula is really the precise Barenblatt profile. It doesn't scale anymore because the scaling has been taken out from the dynamic by means of this coordinate transform. So here is the result. The Hessian of E at U, now this should be a quadratic form, right? And it takes in as argument tangent vectors, and I can take the quadratic form rather than the bilinear one, because getting the bilinear from it is trivial then, polarization. So let me just write it down. This is the W12U norm plus some extra stuff. So this is, of course, the W12U norm. And so I consider these functions modulo constants, because you see constants have to be divided out, otherwise we only have a pseudo-normed rather than a normed space, and it makes perfect sense because constants don't play a role in the geometric meaning here. Only the gradient enters. Okay, so let me continue this formula. Then we have a Hessian of psi. This is now a finite dimensional, well, an n by n matrix, and we take its Hilbert-Schmidt norm, so all the entries squared and added up, minus 1 minus m times the Laplacian of psi of x squared, and I guess the whole stuff has to be integrated against u again. And the nice thing is, oh yes, well, let me first tell you the bad news. Let me see. You're right, thank you. It doesn't make a big difference because I'm going to kill this term in a moment. But it's good to have it correct on the blackboard because everything is videotaped here, so they can pin me down.
You cannot see your M.
You cannot see the M?
No, I see video.
Okay, perfect. So, if you try to minimize this quadratic form under the constraint, of course, that the length is 1, then you get, well, you see you have second derivatives here, you get a fourth order PDE, subject to a constraint, so you get which is second order because psi is linear. Psi has first order derivatives already in this metric here. So that means you get a generalized eigenvalue problem of the form H4 psi minus lambda H2 psi equals 0. these being differential operators of order 4 and 2. Well, this is how I started out, and so I had to learn it the hard way, and I'm pointing this out because if I had known, well, not only known, but also understood this before, I ought to have realized that the correct norm to work on is, of course, this. So I should not do anything in a Hilbert space like L2, but everything should be done in a Hilbert space like this. And this, because we already have the derivative in the Hilbert space, we will get a second-order differential operator. So don't bother doing this. Use the wisdom of infinite-dimensional Riemannian manifolds. You see, the wisdom, not the technology. So shouldn't forget anything. Yeah, so this should be written as psi, and now some operator H psi, a quadratic form in this Hilbert space. Well, let's have a look. There is a little lemma. I better copy it. This is just integration by parts back and forth. It's actually just juggling around derivatives. This equals 1/2 times the Laplacian of gradient psi squared minus gradient psi dot gradient of Laplace psi. Let me just check this. Yep. And so if you do this, if you use this lemma, you can rewrite this Hessian e to the u, a little bit of calculation, in the form psi h psi, I'm going to say what h is in a little moment, w12u, plus there is some extra term Laplace of u to the m plus the divergence of xu. I think I called it divergence sometime before, so let me use this notation again, times gradient psi squared. And the good thing is that this equals zero if u is the Bärenblatt profile. So, what is this operator H? This is minus m rho to the m minus 2. Yes. Divergence of rho times gradient psi. Of course, you can also write it in a different way, and both ways will be. I'm now letting u equals rho. So rho to the m minus 1 times the Laplacian plus x dot the gradient. Of course. And so you see there is a second order differential operator and we want to calculate its spectrum. And the good news is that this can be done explicitly by means of special functions, namely by means of hypergeometric functions. But before I do this, I want to show you how the spectrum looks like. Do I have any comments on what?
The linearization one, the relationship between this linearization and
No, actually, I don't. But you can compare. They look very similar. One should probably calculate. Let me see. Where do we have it? Where is the other one?
Top board.
Top board.
Right-hand side towards the bottom.
Well, it looks a bit funny because there is a different sign. But the different sign of the Laplacian is no issue because it's negative, the gradient, and here I haven't done anything. So this is a negative definite operator. This is a positive definite operator, but it's negative counts. So the only issue is about comparing these fellows. Well, I think I haven't checked it. There should be a kind of... these operators should essentially be equivalent, and one should calculate the conjugating operator. I haven't done it. Okay, fine. So let's have a look. Hey, where is the pointer? So there was a decomposition done in radial and angular coordinates, of course. Now, these different colors and the corresponding branches correspond to the eigenvalue of the spherical Laplacian. So with the spherical Laplacian, there is a quantum number little l, traditionally called little l, associated. So here we have l equals 0, l equals 1, l equals 2, l equals 3, etc. So these boldface lines actually represent continuous spectrum. And so the lower part of this boldface is actually the threshold of the continuous spectrum. And now the printing, there is some hardware limitations. You should think of this fading away. Enough, not because the spectrum fades away, but because I want to fade it away so that it doesn't cover up everything, because all the continuous spectrum in each of these operators extends all the way up. But if I did this, then there would be a horrible mess. And then there are eigenvalues depending on the parameter m, and you can see them here, and they come out of the continuous spectrum. And so there are certain crossings. And so this is essentially the spectrum, and I'm going to show you how to obtain it. So let me just move this up again. Up. How far are we? So... So it turns out that this operator considered on the Hilbert space W12 rho is essentially self-adjoint. So the first thing is you say, okay, let's restrict it to compactly supported smooth functions, and then it's always clear what it means. And now you take the closure of this operator and you find that the closure is self-adjoint. And this closure, so the domain of self-adjointness is, I guess I have to move this up a little bit. Well, through log. Well, you may wonder, why do I want three derivatives? This is a second-order differential operator, but when you apply it, you still want to have one derivative so that you are in this space. Intersected with, of course, should be a subset of the space, so the local constraint doesn't give any decay. And then when you have this, then applying the operator makes actually sense. And then you want, so this is now to be understood just as a differential algebraic expression, which will come up with a W12 log solution, and so this should again be in the original space. So this is the domain of H. And it turns out, well, this formula makes it obvious which one. this one, because, well, not quite yet. Oh, yes. If you plug it in and do one integration by parts, you get the quadratic form, and it's obviously positive, or at least non-negative, whereas the negativity of the quadratic form up here is not obvious at all. And, well, we want, of course, a non-negative form, because otherwise we wouldn't even have stability. Well, that would be too bad, because we know that we have convergence to this to the Baron-Platt solution, and we are just discussing how fast it converges. So otherwise we would refute, if it were not positive, this form, we would refute the work by Friedman and Kamin. Well, that would also be a paper refuting an older one, but we want to be nice, so we better hope that it's correct. So let's see. The Laplacian on the sphere commutes with this operator, so they can be diagonalized simultaneously, and it has the eigenvalues L times L plus N minus 2. Of course, from mechanics you know the case N equals 3 for L equals 0, 1, 2, etc. With certain multiplicities, which I'm not going to write down here, and the reference for this is the nice book by Berger, Godichon, and Mazet. This is Lecture Notes in Mathematics, number 194, Le Spectre d'une Variété Riemannienne. Well, this reference, of course, it's kind of known, so this reference is all, has already a star again. Well, if you don't like that it's in French, I'm sorry, I can't help it, because I don't know another reference. So let's see. I should write down the restriction of the operator onto the radial subspaces that belong to this decomposition according to spherical eigenvalues. And it's not too surprising how it looks like. Negative m rho to the m minus 1 times d2 over dr square plus n minus 1 over r d dr. That's, of course, the radial part of the Laplacian. Then you have L times L plus n minus 1. Wait a minute, the Laplacian is negative definite, so we should better have a negative here, right? Yes. Over r squared. Minus 2, thank you. And then we have plus r d dr. And so now we have an ordinary differential operator, second order. And if you look, oh, where is the Baron-Platt profile? It has vanished away. That's too bad. In any case, you get constant plus r square here. So it had an exotic exponent, and this is just undone again. So now you have a rational function as coefficients. And that's very nice, because there is a little theory known for over 100 years ago by Frobenius and others on ordinary differential equations in the complex plane. And the first thing you do when you see such a thing is you look for singular points. And there is a distinction between regular singular points and irregular singular points. Now that sounds a bit funny, but that's probably due to the translation, because when they figured it out in the 19th century in German, they called it what would translate as weak and strong singular points. But it hasn't been translated that way, so you have to go with these funny names. And the point is, well, what is a singular point at all? First, you solve for the highest derivative, like you pretend to want. You pretend you want to use Picard-Lindelöf. And then you, of course, encounter singularities. Well, you already have encountered the singularity at zero, but you will also encounter singularities at plus minus I times the square root of this constant, because if you divide through. And so the question is whether these singularities are regular or irregular. Oh, and you might also expect the singularity at infinity. And the question is there as well. Well, a singularity is called regular. Well, how can you determine whether a singularity is regular? Quite simple. You count the number of poles, the order of the pole. And one order in the pole counts as much as one derivative. So for instance, let's look at the at zero. So here you have pole order 1 and you have one derivative that makes 2. Here you have pole order 2 and no derivative that makes 2 as well. Here you have 2. Now if the lower order terms are not worse according to this counting scheme than the higher order term, then it's a regular singularity. If I had r to the 3, that would be worse than this second order here, and so then it would be an irregular singularity. So, and if you have only regular singularities, the local solution can be described in terms of power series, except for a factor which is just an irrational power, so r to any complex number alpha, or possibly logarithmic terms. But no essential singularities. Essential singularities only arise if you have irregular singularities in the differential equation. And, for instance, let me not discuss too much about this anymore. In any case, there is a little theorem. I don't know by whom, and it has been done long ago, probably by Frobenius or Fuchs, I'm not quite sure. If an ordinary differential equation of second order in C has exactly 3 regular singularities, and no irregular ones, then the solutions can be expressed in terms of Gauss hypergeometric functions. 2F1. And so these functions come with certain parameters, A, B, C, and so they are power series, and the coefficients are, well, there are all these fancy symbols here, and these symbols, A parenthesis N, that just means A times A plus 1 times etc., all together N factors. So where are the 3 singularities? You may say 0 and plus minus I r times the square root of constant. Well, too bad, that's not true. There is a 4th one, which is also regular at infinity, and you only see it if you do the transformation r equals 1 over s and then make the local analysis at s equals 0. So we have 4 of them, but you see, actually, this can be expressed in terms of r squared. And you get the 3 singularities, namely at r squared equals 0, r squared equals infinity, and r squared equals negative constant. And you do a little Möbius transform, actually only a trivial scaling, to bring this negative constant to plus 1, because the singularities of this function are at 0, 1, and infinity. Of course, the series only converges in a unique disk, but you can have analytic continuation, and all this has been done long ago, and you can find it in the books on special functions. Why am I stressing this? Why am I not just writing down these solutions and say, look up in Abramovich Degun or Magnus Oberhettinger or any of these special functions books? Well, because this theorem and this looking around for regular and irregular singularities, that's the table of contents for these special functions books. So these books are typically very thick, and if you want to know what function you are looking at, then you need to study the singularities, and then you know what type of function you have. Only the bad thing is that the books don't tell you this information, and they don't have classes anymore about it either. Okay, But now you know it, and now you have these formulas, and you can write down a basis of solutions. And hey, where did I? Let me write down only one of them for the equation HL of psi equals lambda psi. These are little psi's now. So that's R to the L 2F1, and I am a bit short of time, so I'm not going to write down all these parameters. In any case, the eigenvalue parameter enters here. There is a second solution which is singular at zero, so it doesn't go in the space. And now it's only the question, how do these functions behave at infinity? And so you need connection formulas. I don't go into details. However, if any of these Hochhammer symbols in the numerator, if the A or the B turns out to be a non-positive integer, then you see that the series terminates because you will come up with a factor zero here and you get a polynomial. And these are exactly the situations when this function actually lies in the space. In the other cases, it will also not lie in this Hilbert space because it grows too fast at infinity. And so this is the eigenvalue condition. Is that A is a non-positive integer. And of course the polynomial can also have too high a degree, so you don't get arbitrarily many eigenvalues, because if the degree of the polynomial is too high, then it also doesn't lie in the space anymore. You also have situations where A and B become complex conjugate, then you find out that you have just barely the growth, which it doesn't lie in the space anymore, but the integrability condition just gives logarithmic divergence, and this will give the continuous spectrum. And then you need to check that all the rest is actually in the resolvent set. That means you need to do variation of parameters, the usual stuff, and then estimate these things. Well, the estimates are not quite so obvious. I thought for a while I could do it elementarily, but then I realized that I made a little bit of a blunder. And however, to do it correctly, you can use Marcinkiewicz's interpolation theorem, and I'm not quite sure whether it can be avoided. But, well, alas, the little lesson on Marcinkiewicz's interpolation theorem has been cancelled due to timeout. And so let me just finish up by giving you the spectrum again. And actually there are two pictures on the spectrum here. Instead of M, we use a variable P, which gives the number of moments so as soon as P is larger than 7, the Baron-Blatt solution has 7 moments. And so it's essentially the same picture. And just a little advertisement, if you want this kind of nice pictures, don't rely on any symbolic algebra software. It's worthwhile doing one's own PostScript programming. Okay, so that ends the talk. Thank you for your attention.
Questions? Comments?
I will comment. But first, critical remark, I so much supported that, but now I understood that there exists misunderstanding, which once should be taken out. So, first, functional analysis was created for specific goals. These goals were, understand, spectrum, operators, linear PDE, and orbital differential. Accidentally, its work could be adapted to some nonlinear questions. This was bad luck of functional analysis, because as a result, previous generation, not only for you, but even a little bit for me, decided that it may deal with that, which is not. Okay? And now people who cannot apply theory which does not exist feel insulted that they cannot apply this. So you should work independently. It was not created for this goal. So it was not created to create analysis on infinite dimensional space. So not for function, not for measures, it's absolutely not suitable. And of course not for manifold, because you cannot connect them. You have nothing to connect. And so it cannot be. So it's good that at least, wisdom may work, which also may not work, but definitely not technique. And all this book which says the technique exists, you just don't buy.
Okay. Yeah, so there's two remarks that I would like to point out while the pictures of the spectrum are up. So the first one was that in my talk there was a change in critical behavior when the nonlinearity m went to the value 1 minus 1 over m. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the lowest crossing of two eigenvalues. And so the point is that the flat line in this picture is the eigenvalue corresponding to translations. And the other one is the eigenvalue corresponding to dilations. And they change stability indices.
Yeah, so let's see. Here we have the translations, and here we have the dilations, which... So I mentioned the translations in the beginning, that if you shift it, of course... this has not been modded out by the...
There are these other dotted lines. So this is sort of a phase transition at the bottom of the spectrum. These other dotted lines indicate other crossings, multiple crossings that, they happen to be there if we don't need them. And the other remark is about the right-hand edge of the spectrum on the right. It's the spectrum for the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck generator, and it corresponds with the positive integers. So there's no continuous spectrum at m equals 1 because all polynomials are integrable against the Gaussian.
All right. Oh, I should make one remark myself. I forgot, I meant to, but that kind of was the time issue, to refer to Carrillo, Liederman, Markovic, and Toscani. So they had, they have lower bounds for the spectrum. And so if you take this point and take, this point and take a straight line through here, that's the lower bound which they get. They also have, under some special geometric assumption, centered and radially symmetric, a somewhat better lower bound. It's also a straight line, and it's the one which becomes tangential here at the continuous spectrum. So just for comparison. And you will learn more about this in the next talk, I guess.
In terms of displacement convexity, if I understand, you compute somehow or have a lower bound of the second derivative at the Baron-Blatt density. Any guess of what is the second derivative at any density? I mean, it's possible to give also a lower bound to determine the displacement convexity of this function.
Well, let's see. Let me move this up again for a moment. We still have the formula here. I mean, I don't have an explicit guess right now. Of course, one would hope that it depends continuously. It should, of course, unless there is some functional analytic trouble. Let me just see. One should compare this expression with U, because then we are back in the original norm again. And... So it's a small perturbation because it's zero if U is the Baron-Blatt profile. And so for this should be a very simple type of perturbation theory for spectrum because we are perturbing with I'm not quite sure about the tail behavior. But if we're lucky, it's even a bounded operator. If we're not quite so lucky, it might still be a relatively bounded operator. And so we haven't done these estimates so far, but I think this is a good start for them.
Okay. So I have also. First of all, it's not the lower bound, it's the exact test.
Yeah, no.
And on the other hand, it's known that the Hessian is, that it's displayed in concave and some other place.
Yes.
And so what you can hope for, as Ben is saying, you can hope that it may stay positive nearby and in a neighborhood of the Baron-Blatt profile. And this is probably not true unless you... probably what's closer to being true is you look at a neighborhood in a stronger topology. And then it stays... And the point is that the smoothing behavior of the nonlinear evolution pushes you into these stronger topology neighborhoods. And transparent black profile, then you can expect that probably this lower bound minus epsilon holds.
If one wants to look at the energy with respect to U-hat,
yes,
that you mentioned,
right,
computations can be done, and one expects more convexity? Or
well, one gets more convexity, but in fact, I still think, I mean, my original hope was that that term would turn out to be concave or convex, roughly, but I think that that's too ambitious. I think that that's probably not true. So what I suspect, so there's the non-convexity is in the radial direction in my cone. And I suspect that there's a kind of self-similarity, that you see that non-convexity again and again on all scales and different orientations. But I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Okay. So, thank you again.